All right, thank you. I think I'm ready. I didn't have an introduction, actually. When we last were talking about church history, I had spent several sermons talking about the Apostle Paul and some of the things that he went through. ask them. It's fine for me. Thank you. Some of the things that he had gone through, the way the persecution he suffered, the way people were out to get him, and the fact that when we leave the book of Acts, you recall we were reading in the latter chapters of the book of Acts that Paul had realized that he had been accused of teaching Jews to not keep the law, and that James and the other, but the apostles there in Jerusalem said, we have many converts, many brethren who are zealous for the law. These are people that have been converted there in Judea, around Jerusalem, who were zealous for the law of God. And that Paul himself went to the temple, paid the expenses for several people that were finishing a vow, probably a Nazarite vow. He himself was apparently finishing up a vow that he had taken some period of time before. And that was actually what set in motion the events that resulted in his martyrdom, because he had brought with him a Gentile, probably several, but he had been seen around town with this Gentile. And Jerusalem was a small town at the time, and it's kind of probably, well, I would say it's smaller than a place like Lititz, but I can't compare it to any towns that you're in, maybe like a Gettysburg or something where, maybe somewhat bigger, but people knew what was going on. So when Paul came back to town, and he had been trained there, he had this Gentile with him, people noticed that. And they accused him, remember, of bringing that Gentile into the temple, into the areas where Gentiles were not allowed. That was the accusation, and that's what got him arrested because of the tumult. And although the Festus and Felix and all couldn't find anything wrong with him, the Jewish leaders continued to make all kinds of accusations about him. And in the end, he got to a free trip to Rome, in the belly of a ship, with the slaves and whoever else. And he was able to witness in the court of the emperor. So it worked for good. And perhaps, we speculated that he may have been able to take a trip even after that, have some freedom before he was martyred. And I said that when I continued the series, that I intended to explain how we got from a church that was keeping the Sabbath, that was following a lot of the Jewish customs, to a church that in AD 325 at the Council of Nicaea was replacing the Passover with Easter and making sure that those days would never fall on the same day. And by later on in the 4th century was very anti-Sabbath. How do we get from the church that you read about in the New Testament to the church that existed several centuries later? And I'm not going to be able to cover that in one message, but I decided to focus on the Sabbath and Sunday, just one facet of that. And even then, I'm not going to get very far. But I hope that this will be interesting to you. It was interesting to me when I did the research. There are a lot of books out there and a lot of, various worth and various different perspectives. But I title this Sabbath Sunday from the sources, because what I did is on my in my library, both on my computer and back in my office, I have a lot of English translations of the original writings from the first and second centuries. And what I wanted to do is just look at them and let you come to your own conclusions. I will help you come to some conclusions. I will also play some videos where other people have their conclusions. But you don't need to believe mine or someone else's. I'm going to present you with some of the original evidence and tell you where it is, so you can look for yourself if you'd like to. To me, that was interesting, and I don't want to spend a lot of time. I've got a book here, and this is it's some of it a criticism, I guess. This is From Sabbath to Sunday by Samuel Bakayoki. It's a good book, a lot of information in here. One of the things he does, however, is he says, well, it could have been, or it must have been, or we can look here, and it's probably this way. It's a lot of supposition. He's got the original sources in here, and he could have stuck with that. But he over and over again draws conclusions from them that are not, in my opinion, completely proven by the sources. On the other hand, I've got another book in my library called From Sabbath to Lord's Day. It's edited by D.A. Carson. It's got a lot of different writers that are involved in the production of this book. That's on the opposite extreme, explaining why Sunday is the day we keep and why it should be and how it originated in Palestine. And again, they have the original sources and they come to entirely different conclusions because of the probablys and the maybes and weak and suspects. So that's my opinion about that. I think you can look at the sources and come to your own conclusions. First, we have the New Testament. There are several scriptures in the New Testament that speak to the first day of the week. We know about the Sabbath. I'm not going back there. I'm not going to preach to the choir here. You know about the Sabbath, and you know how it's taught in the Bible, and that's not the purpose of this message. But how do we begin to hear about Sunday? Well, some people say Mark 16:9 and various other verses in the New Testament. Now after he had risen early on the first day of the week, he appeared to Mary Magdalene, from whom he had cast out seven demons. Ah, there. Bible talks about the first day of the week. There's an original source, a first century source that talks about the first day of the week. We shouldn't be surprised, because it shouldn't come as any surprise to you that back in the first century there were also 7 days in the week, and one of them was the first day. So the fact that the Bible mentions the first day of the week shouldn't be a surprise, and it doesn't prove anything. It happens to be the day on which he first appeared to Mary Magdalene, from whom he had cast out seven demons. You can look in Matthew, you can look in the book of John, and you'll see that there are other descriptions of this same day. It's the day when Jesus began to appear to people after he was resurrected. And also in John 20, and I think it's verse 26, it mentions 8 days later, which in the lingo of the time meant the next week on the same day. So again, that's just talking about a Sunday when something happened. Now, if you read this book, and I have other ones at home that are worse than this one, they'll say, well, look, Jesus is setting the example here. He's seeing people, he's meeting with people on the first day of the week, and that's why we meet on the first day of the week. This one doesn't say it too much. It kind of hints at it. But I have other books that flat out say it, and I didn't bring you those quotes. But here's the original. We just have Jesus, who had been resurrected, and he began to meet with people on the first day of the week, because that's the day that the first day he could have. He was resurrected. We figure he was resurrected late the night before, or late the day before. In any event, there's nothing in the New Testament, in any of these scriptures anyway, that suggests that you or I or anybody else should observe the first day of the week. And there are two other scriptures that I want to mention, maybe three, in the New Testament, that some people, again, this book and other books like it, will say, well, here's the scriptures that talk about the first day in the New Testament and why we think we should keep it. Acts 20, verse 7 says, on the first day of the week, when we gathered together to break bread, Paul began talking to them, intending to leave the next day. And he prolonged his message until midnight. So long-winded preachers are nothing new. I have biblical support for talking a long time here. All right? Y'all don't buy that, do you? It said that he talked until midnight. They're gathered together to break bread, and it says the first day of the week. Now, to read the rest of the story, just read a few verses here. There was a young man named Eutychus who was sitting on the windowsill, and he was sinking into a deep sleep. So again, some things have never changed in church. This isn't exactly church. But he sank into a deep sleep, and Paul kept on talking, because speakers are trained to ignore people that are sleeping and just keep going. And Paul was no different. And he was. And finally, this fellow was overcome by sleep, and he fell down from the third floor, and they thought he was dead. And if he wasn't, or either wasn't, or he was resurrected, whatever, but he had got back up, and they broke the bread and ate, and he talked with them a long time, actually until daybreak, and then left. So Eutychus was okay, and Paul talked all the way until the sun came up the next morning. And then he left. Now, this was on the occasion when he was leaving town, and so these people wanted to spend one last time with him. Now, what is this? It doesn't say that they had a church service on the first day of the week, but it does say they had a meeting. But it says the meeting was that they were gathering together to break bread. Also that Paul talked until midnight. Now, what do you gather from this? What time of day was it when Paul was talking? Anybody?
It was right after the Sabbath.
Seems to be after the Sabbath. Seems that he talked until the sun came up on Sunday. Some people say, well, first day of the week means they had this fellowship meal on Sunday, and that he talked until Monday morning. Could be. Either way, it doesn't say it was a service and that we need to do it. But it appears to be some kind of a fellowship meal. In the New Testament, when they talk about breaking bread, it was more than just it was time to eat. It was something that meant more to them in the early Christians.
Any of the sources you read, did they happen to mention the Haggadah service that the Jews performed?
No.
And the Sabbath.
They didn't mention that, but you want to share that?
Well, the Jews, when the Sabbath ends, they'll wait till 45 minutes to an hour after the Sabbath is over, and they'll have a meal. And they'll have a candle lighting thing where they light the candles and they'll douse it in wine. And it's an ancient ceremony. And there is one scripture here, and I can't find it, but it mentions about they lit the lamps. So after that service was performed, they would light lamps.
Oh, it's in probably verse 8, if you look. I think it's, or maybe it was before verse 7. It's either verse 8. It's verse 8, okay.
At least in this one.
Yeah.
And there were many lights in the upper chamber. My interlinear translates that many lamps were in the upper room where they had assembled. So there's a possibility that that's what was going on here. And that ended the Sabbath, and he just went on and talked with that. I've heard that from one source, so.
Shelby and I experienced that at my brother's wedding. They had the ceremony and then they ate. And that's like you said, it's ancient. They still do it. And there was, I think, incense. We passed some incense around, smelled that, and they had the wine. And then we had the meal. So breaking bread has more significance. We read that sometimes in the New Testament. Maybe you read that and you think, oh, it's time to eat. I maintain, and I think you have some other people here that might say the same thing, that when you read that they broke bread, it meant something more significant. In the Jewish community, it meant something more significant. And then in the Christian community, it was even up, the bar was raised a notch, because Jesus said, now that bread and that wine have new symbolism. So I believe that when you read that they broke bread, it meant something important, something significant. And it wasn't just a meal. And this, of course, again, there's nothing here about a church service, although Paul was speaking. And even, if Paul was visiting here, I'm sure, and he was going to be here on Sunday, I'm sure we'd have a meeting, or whatever day of the week it was. So that doesn't necessarily prove anything one way or the other. To me, it doesn't. Some dispute the timing, but at most, I say, this is my opinion, at most this may indicate the Christians assembled for fellowship meals on Sunday. Not that they had abandoned the Sabbath. As Mike says, it was an appendage to the Sabbath. You have the Sabbath, you had the certain things that you did on the Sabbath that was very special. And then after that, oftentimes they would stop and have a meal or another meal. Perhaps they already had meals on the Sabbath, but then they could have another one spend time together. Now, does that sound foreign to you? No, it doesn't. We've got a whole table full of stuff, and after the Sabbath, we sit down and have a meal together. It's something that Christians have been doing ever since the beginning of the church. So it shouldn't surprise anyone. Again, if this is where you have to go to find evidence for Sunday keeping in the New Testament, then go ahead. But to me, it's not very good evidence. 1 Corinthians chapter 16, and in other verses in the New Testament, you read that Paul was organizing a collection. Now, concerning the collection of the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, so you do also. On the first day of each week, every one of you is to put aside and save as he may prosper, that no collections be made when I come. When I arrive, whomever you may approve, I will send them with letters to carry your gift to Jerusalem. So there was a certain amount of poverty in Judea, and Paul was organizing a distribution among the churches. Now, can you think of any reasons why he might want to do that? I wasn't thinking of this before, but why would Paul want to organize a collection and then have this money taken, apparently by people from Corinth even, have money taken to Jerusalem. As it turned out, Paul was able to take it himself, and he probably took some other people from the churches along with him. But why did he have this plan? Can you think of any good reasons for that? Anybody? No? I mean, first of all, it was something that it was always part of the law, the Torah from the Old Testament. You take care of the poor. You remember when Paul, what happened in Acts 15? They settled this issue about circumcision. They had these things that Paul was supposed to tell the Jews. And the Gentiles, what did they tell him before he left? Remember? What did they tell him to remember? Be mindful of. Take care of the poor, remember? Which he said he would, he was always mindful of that. He wasn't going to forget that. So, that's one good reason, just because it was part of the culture to take care of the poor. But another reason, I hadn't thought about this before. Paul was being criticized by who? Who was criticizing Paul all the time? In Jerusalem. Hint. Well, yeah, fair people from the Pharisee party, but Jews in general. Why? Because they figured he was leading the Jews and Gentiles away from the law. What better way to try to patch over that and heal it a little bit than to have a collection among the Gentile churches for the poor back in Jerusalem and bring that money and actually send it back to Jerusalem with some Gentiles bringing it? So maybe you had some proud people, some proud Jews there in Jerusalem, but were they going to say, nah, we don't want your money. We don't need your help. Yeah, we don't know exactly what happened, though, how that gift was received. I don't think it was that bad, but in Judea, you read records that they had a system, I think I might have mentioned this before, in the synagogue, where they did a collection on Friday of foodstuffs. Why? So they could have food to take care of the widows the next week. All right? Remember Acts 6? Why did they have to appoint 7 people? I don't remember if I talked about this here or not. The widows, the Grecian widows, the widows from out of town were not being taken care of, right? And there were some mumblings going on. And the apostle said, look, we don't have time to wait on tables. We don't have time to do this collection and see that the right people get this. You take care of it yourselves. And he told them to pick 7, right? We call them deacons. The Acts doesn't call them deacons. Pick 7. If you look through the names of those 7, there's not a Hebrew name on there. They're all Greeks from out of town. He told the people from out of town, the apostles told the people from out of town, okay, you got a problem here? Pick 7 of your leaders to take care of it. And we'll appoint them over this business and everybody be happy. So they had in the church a similar system to the synagogue system where they took a collection and they made sure there was enough food to take care of the widows for the following week. It seems to me that Paul is initiating something in the Gentile churches that's very similar, saying, we have poor people back in Jerusalem we need to help take care of. Please do a collection. Now, what difference does it make what day they make the collection? Well, I suggest, this is just me, that, why did the Jews collect on Friday and not Saturday? Why didn't they say, bring the food to the synagogue on Sabbath and we'll distribute it on Sunday? Why didn't they do that? Anybody? Right. And they had a lot of rules about Sabbath. We bring food here, and we don't have a problem with that, but the Pharisees had rules. You couldn't carry food beyond your area that you lived. Right? What if you wanted to share a meal with your neighbor? You know what they did? Anybody know? Mike knows what they did. He's laughing. What did they do?
Well, they extended the boundaries. They They actually do that in the Orthodox community over here in Harrisburg.
Okay.
They have an area. I forget what it's called. But they extend the boundaries so you can walk further on the Sabbath and carry some things.
So you and your neighbors are in the same quote-unquote household on the Sabbath. You can carry food over there. Well, anyway, we don't have all those kind of regulations. But you don't want to do all this work on the Sabbath. I just figure Paul didn't want to do all this work on the Sabbath, number one, but he did want the goods or the money, however it was done, to be collected before he got there, because he didn't want to just show up and have everybody have to be in a rush. He told me, put it aside. There are some people that want to argue that this is referring to they were to put it up in their own house. And then if they were supposed to put it up in their own house, there's something about some of those words in the Greek that suggests that perhaps they were supposed to put it up in their own house. But if they were supposed to save it in their own house, what difference does it make what day they do it? So that doesn't make any sense to me, but I'll just point that out. Some people say that as well. But in any event, there's nothing here about a worship service. It's a collection on the first day of the week. People say, oh, we have a collection at church, so they must be talking about church. Well, that's called an anachronism, right? You take something from the 21st century and you put it back into the first century. Because there's nothing in the Bible saying that they had a meeting on the first day, and if they did, that they would be taking a collection on that day. This is a collection, but it doesn't say anything about a meeting. So we're reading present customs back into the past. Revelation 1, verse 10, that's the last one. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day. You can believe what you want about that. There are lots of arguments. These books and the others I have at home and on my computer have all kinds of arguments one way and the other. It doesn't make any sense to me that John would make a huge point about what day of the week he had a vision. I don't think there are too many, I don't know, I didn't look, but are there any examples in the whole rest of the Bible of anybody saying what day they had a vision? Maybe a date or a year, so such and such year of the reign of so-and-so, I had this vision, but on a day and on day of the week, it doesn't seem to be relevant. The most logical explanation is that it's referring to the day of the Lord. The eschatological, meaning in the future, the prophesied day of the Lord and all the events that you read about in Revelation. Yes?
Any of your research, did they mention that they had synagogue services every day and worship God every day?
No, I mean, they may have, but I didn't read that. But there were comments, I should say, yeah, maybe not synagogue, but in talking about that there were, in the temple, there were services every day. I think I did read that. Thank you for bringing it up. That there were some services on pretty much any day. And it could be the same way in the Christian church, too. You know, that argument that God doesn't say don't worship on any particular day. You know, it's true. And they had ceremonies in the temple every day. They had ceremonies in the synagogue. Maybe not every synagogue. A small synagogue, would they have them every day? Maybe. I don't know.
My understanding is that it may not be correct. It may not be right.
Could be. Okay. I'm going to blend some videos here in with the sermon. I'm going to try to anyway, if it all works. And these particular clips are from a video entitled The Seventh Day. I was going to tell you who it's put out by, but I don't even know. Revelations from the Lost Pages of History. These people are Seventh-day Adventists, but it's not put out by the church itself. There's six of these. They follow the Sabbath throughout history. Very good. I recommend them. Maybe some of you have seen them. If you have, this is a review. And we will see if I can play them. And I'm trying to play them in a form that will blend in with the sermon well, but we'll see. Here's the first one. For $120, I can get some software that'll put it right into the PowerPoint. I haven't done that yet. Don't know that I will.
When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet,
sorry.
Let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. But pray ye that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day.
With those words, Jesus pointed to a frightening prediction from the Old Testament prophet Daniel. But why would he tell the people to pray that they wouldn't have to escape on the Sabbath, unless he expected them to still be keeping the Sabbath holy?
In the Roman Empire in the year 66, Rome was quite unstable. That's called the year of the four emperors, and the first three did not die of natural causes. So the Jews, an eastern province of the Roman Empire, thought that this was actually a good time to take advantage of Roman instability to press forward for their own freedom from Roman oppression.
The Roman general Vespasian marched against the city in an attempt to quell the uprising. Before the job was done, he became emperor. 69 A.D. And his son Titus, another future emperor, took over as general of the army. Titus laid siege to the city, and finally in 70 AD, the Roman army broke through the defenses, ravaged the city, and completely destroyed the temple. An early church historian reports that the Christians of Jerusalem remembered the warning of Jesus and escaped before the city fell to the Romans.
This story is an obvious intersection of history and prophecy. We know the dates and places, and Jesus predicted and knew when these things would take place, that 40 years after his death and resurrection, his followers would still be keeping the Sabbath.
In fact, throughout the New Testament period, and that takes us to the end of the first century AD, Christians continued to observe the seventh-day Sabbath. That's clear from both the biblical and historical records.
Any comments about that while I try to figure out how to get back to the... There we go. You notice that they say, and of course I agree, that there's no evidence at all from the New Testament that anybody was abandoning the Sabbath. I didn't know where to put this slide, but there gets to be, in early church history, a conflict between Jews who are not Christians and Christians. And I didn't write that in here every single time, but you got to understand it's not just Jews and Christians, because a large majority at the beginning, or at the beginning it's all of them, all the Christians are Jews. So it's not Jewish Christian. It's Christians against non-Christian Jews. And there was, they butt heads over a lot of things, and there are reasons for that. And I don't have them all here, but I'd like to share a few. Rome had, and we talked about this before in some of the history things I've done in the past, Rome had a very lenient approach to Judaism. Why? Because it was an ancient religion. It wasn't some newfound thing that was that they thought, anyway, was going to be some kind of a reason for having a revolution or something like that. Now, they learned that it was a reason for revolution later. Rome's attitude of tolerating the Jews, and in some cases even making special legislation that allowed the Jews to do their thing. And one big example of how the Jews were allowed to be Jews and allowed to do their thing is part of what made it possible for Jesus to come to the temple. And Jim spoke about this in history, is the Herods. Why would Rome allow the Herods to run the area of Judea? Why? First of all, the Herods were very clever, as Jim pointed out. Very clever, very violent, but they were very clever. But the Romans realized that they'd get less trouble from the Jews if they let a Jew, Herod was at least supposedly part Jewish, let a Jew run things as a vassal king. So the Romans kind of, in a way, bent over backwards to allow the Jews to have their way and to practice their religion. However, in 66 or so A.D., we had the rebellion there in Jerusalem. And then, as you just saw in the video, and then there was another one in 135, the Bar Kokhba revolt. And the temple was destroyed in the first one. And then Hadrian, as I have here on this note, Hadrian himself, the emperor in 135, had made certain regulations that favored the Jews, but then later he reversed those. And because the Jews were giving him trouble. It's also, I wanted to put this in here, I don't know where it belongs, but I wanted to say that the first 15 bishops, according to Eusebius, the first 15 bishops of Jerusalem were all Jewish. And that's significant. And it wasn't until after 135 that you see some Greek names among the bishops of Jerusalem. So the church in Jerusalem doesn't appear anyway to be departing from Jewish practices. At least, you know, there was a certain attachment to them. But Rome, as a government, because of what happened in 66, because of what happened again in 132 to 135, began to have more of an attitude against the Jews and actually persecute the Jews. All right? If you were a Christian, just think this through. If you were a Christian, in what way would you perhaps suffer because of this persecution of Jews? Because of a Roman attitude against the Jews. How could you suffer? Or what could you do that might cause you to suffer?
Keeping the Sabbath.
You keep the Sabbath, then they just look at you as one of the Jews. Or circumcision, those are the two things, main things. Not worshiping idols and other things also included there. When Rome began to persecute Christians, now we go back to AD 66 again, Nero, the one who ended up being, I guess he was the one who ended up being emperor after after the four of them in the 1 year and all that, you know, all that confusion. But Nero was emperor around that time. And he blamed the Christians, remember, for the fire in Rome. Now Jews could find it to their advantage to be dissociated from the Christians so they wouldn't suffer because Christians were being persecuted. And Christians were persecuted very much in the empire up until 321 or 313, I think is the year. We will see the Birkat Haminim, Birkat Haminim, if I can say that right in Hebrew, is part of the synagogue benediction. Benediction means blessing. And this happened during the latter part of the first century. It was actually in a sense, it's a blessing that cursed Christians. They had a regular, 18, Mike says it's 18 blessings, and they added.
I'm sorry, what?
It was the 19th. They added one. And it actually cursed Christians. So not only did you have the Christians who had reasons to kind of divide themselves from Jews, but now you had Jews with reasons to divide themselves from Christians. Go ahead.
Did any of your sources say that was before the Christians came?
No.
My understanding is that was added during the time of the Maccabees, but I could be wrong.
No,
I literally written anywhere, but it was changed.
They said it was at the sources I had said it was added to the synagogue benedictions somewhere. They guessed around 80, but I mean sometime after the destruction of the temple.
I'm not sure that is correct, but that it was directed towards Christian at that time is definitely correct.
So there could have been your point is that there may have been a curse previously that was more generic to just any enemies of the Jews, but at this time it becomes directed at Christians. Okay, thank you. I didn't read that anywhere. So Christians were not welcome in the synagogues like they were before, because before, if you were a Christian, you were considered a sect of Judaism, just like the Pharisees are a sect, or the Sadducees are a sect, or you know, you have all these different people with different beliefs within Judaism as a whole. And I'm reading a book, big thick book, about the New Testament in the time of God's people. Oh, I forget what it's called now. God, the New Testament and the people of God. And he goes to great lengths to show that Judaism is not a big unified whole. There are many, many different beliefs within Judaism in the first century. But they're all Jews because there are certain things they hold in common. Now you come to the latter part of the first century, and Christians are no longer welcome in the synagogue. Why? Well, I won't go into more detail because you'll see it in one of the video clips. Another reason that there was some antipathy, you read this in the writings of the fathers, and you read it in writings even yet today, especially through the Middle Ages, big time through the Middle Ages. The Jews are not only people who deny Christ, but they are the ones that killed him. As if somehow that's a problem. I think this through, and I think, all right, if somebody wouldn't have killed Christ, you wouldn't have a Savior, there would be no Christian church. So what's your problem here? Somebody had to kill him. But they said, well, the Jews killed him, so we hate the Jews. Well, then who else would have killed him? Somebody's got to kill him, or he doesn't die. It just doesn't make sense. I'm being too logical, I guess. All right, let's go to another, if I can do this, go to another clip here.
us to an intriguing question. If the first century Christians observed the Sabbath of the Old Testament, the seventh-day Sabbath of creation and the fourth commandment, why do most Christians today observe Sunday? When did the change from Saturday to Sunday take place? Does the biblical record provide any clue? The first four books of the New Testament are among the oldest Christian documents. St. Mark wrote his book first, a report on the life of Christ. That was 55 A.D. or later. The writings of Saints Matthew and Luke probably date sometime between the late 60s and A.D. 80. St. John, the last surviving original disciple of Christ, wrote his book near the end of the first century. Despite their late dates, from 30 to 70 years after the death of Christ, these books contain not even the slightest hint that Jesus himself or his disciples considered changing the day of rest and worship from the seventh day of the week to the first.
It's especially significant that New Testament writers never refer to the first day of the week as the Sabbath. To them, the seventh day was the Sabbath. And this is consistent with all of the other evidence that to the end of the first century, Christians were worshiping with Jews in the synagogue on the Sabbath.
About 95 or 100 AD, a change was made in the synagogue service. The middle part of the service is known as the standing prayer, the Amidah, or the 18 benedictions, consisting of 18 short prayers or blessings of God, Thanksgiving blessings. All 18 are recited on weekdays, on Sabbaths only seven. But at this time, an additional one was added. It's known in Hebrew as the Birkat Hamanim, the blessing concerning the heretics, but it's not really a blessing.
May the apostates have no hope. May the dominion of wickedness be speedily uprooted in our day. May the Nazarenes and the heretics quickly perish and not be inscribed together with the righteous. Blessed art thou, the eternal our God, who crushes the wicked.
It smoked out the Christian, because anyone could be asked to lead out in the recitation of this. Anybody or everybody was supposed to say amen at the end of each one. And this made it very uncomfortable, in fact impossible, for Christians to participate in the Pharisee-led synagogue service from that time onward.
The evidence of this synagogue prayer helped sharpen our picture of first century Christians. It's clear that they were keeping the Sabbath right along with their Jewish brothers. So now the Jews were becoming less tolerant of Christians. But Christians themselves were beginning to question the value of their connection to Judaism.
In the early church literature, Christians are really desperate to separate from Judaism and to distinguish themselves. As a result, there is the appearance of a great deal of anti-Judaism or anti-Semitism. Some of it is invective, nasty comments about Jews. Some of it is pushing away from what they saw as Old Testament religion.
There were practical reasons for the Christians to distance themselves from the Jews. No doubt they were swept up in the current of anti-Jewish sentiment. Not surprising given the level of conflict between Jews and the Roman Empire at the time.
Although the Jews were scattered throughout the Mediterranean region and beyond, many of them still dreamed of a great Jewish nation and ultimate victory over their enemies. And in North Africa, around 115 AD, these dreams flared into violence.
The Jews in the region of Cyrene had put a certain Andreas at their head and were destroying both the Romans and the Greeks. Many they sawed in two from the head downwards. Others they gave to the wild beasts, and still others they forced to fight as gladiators. In all, 220,000 persons perished. In Egypt, too, they perpetrated many similar outrages, and in Cyprus, Dio Cassius.
A few years later, in 132, Jewish opposition to imperial authority exploded into another violent revolt. This time, it was in Jerusalem.
Our ancient sources give us two reasons for the Bar Kokhba uprising. First, a prohibition by the Roman Emperor Hadrian, a prohibition against circumcision. Jews would no longer be allowed to practice circumcision. Second, the decision by the Emperor Hadrian to rebuild Jerusalem as a pagan city, city of Aelia Capitolina.
Imperial forces finally crushed the rebellion in 135. Hadrian banned Jews from Jerusalem and prohibited Sabbath keeping and other Jewish rites of religion.
So there was strong anti-Jewish sentiment throughout the Roman Empire. Jews were the enemy. Christians didn't want to be associated with the Jews and thought it was the enemy. And the easy way to disassociate themselves was to renounce the Sabbath, which was a mark of Jewishness.
So where and when did Christians first begin to observe an alternate day of worship? The lost pages of history lead us in a surprising direction.
Any comments? I have one. That clip about the violence there that is, what was his name? From Cyrene. It was Dio something. I forget his name now. I read that in some sources, and it seems to me, just for your information, it seems to me that was written by, it was obviously written by a Roman, Dio Cassius. It was written by a Roman about the Jews. And when you see it in this video, it makes it seem as if the Jews rebelled and then they were treated this way. They were sawing people, and I mean that they were being sawed or whatever. If you read the sources, the original sources, it seems to me that this was the accusation that the Romans had against the Jews, that the Jews were acting like this and being violent. That's the way it reads to me. And I think that one of the sources here says that that's the way it reads. So anyway, there was obviously hatred between the Jews and the Christians that was growing, and growing during the first century, especially after the temple was destroyed by Titus in 70 AD. Now I have a few other resources here for you. One of them is Ignatius of Antioch. Now, Ignatius of Antioch lived somewhere around 35 to 108. They really don't know. Some people say 50 to something and whatever. He lived in the latter part of the first century and barely into the second century. He was the third bishop of Antioch. Antioch was in a up north of Jerusalem. Okay, now there were several. I'm not sure which Jerusalem this was. I mean, which Antioch this was. But he was the third bishop of Antioch. There are traditions, not that they're true, but to show you the approximate age of Ignatius, there are traditions that he was the infant or the young, very young child that Jesus picked up and blessed in the Gospels. He is supposed to have been a student of the Apostle John. There's no hard evidence of that, but there's that's one of the beliefs. One of the traditions. He wrote a series of letters on his way to martyrdom in Rome. He was going to be martyred, obviously, 108 AD or whenever that was. And he wrote letters, some of which we have copies of. One of them was a letter to the Magnesians. And Magnesia was a place in Asia Minor. It was upstream up the river from Ephesus in Asia Minor. We have copies of this particular letter and some others in a short and a long version. I want to share with you the short version from chapter 9 of Ignatius' epistle to the Magnesians. If, therefore, those who were brought up in the ancient order of things have come to the possession of a new hope, no longer observing the Sabbath, but living in the observance of the Lord's day, on which also our life has sprung up again by him and by his death, whom some deny, and so on. So, you know, the question is, all right, we've got the Sabbath, and now, you know, now, today, people are observing Sunday. How was there a transition? How did that happen? We don't have a lot of sources on that, but I'm going to share with you a few that we do have. This one from Ignatius. This is the short version. Sounds like people at the time of his death, which is the first decade of the second century, are no longer observing the Sabbath, but keeping Sunday, the Lord's Day. This is the short version. Let's look at the long version of this same epistle. And we don't know which one is more accurate, which one has been redacted in later years, we don't really know. Here's the long version. Let us therefore no longer keep the Sabbath after the Jewish manner, and rejoice in days of idleness. For he that does not work, let him not eat. For, say the holy oracles, in the sweat of your face you shall eat your bread. But let every one of you keep the Sabbath after a spiritual manner, rejoicing in meditation on the law, not in relaxation of the body, admiring the workmanship of God, and not eating things prepared the day before, nor using lukewarm drinks, and walking within a prescribed space, nor finding delight in dancing and plaudits which have no sense in them. And after the observance of the Sabbath, let every friend of Christ keep the Lord's Day as a festival, the resurrection day, the queen and chief of all the days. Now, I don't know if you've ever read that before, but to me that's very interesting. Whether Ignatius wrote it literally on the way to his martyrdom or somebody edited it later, what you have here, in the long version anyway, is a comparison of keeping the Sabbath in a certain way to keeping it another way. And notice the addition of Sunday. You look in the sources, nowhere do you find, and a competent scholar today nor a competent theologian will claim this. They will not claim that the Sabbath has been replaced by Sunday. If anyone who knows what they're talking about will not say that, because there's no evidence ever that Sabbath was replaced by Sunday. But there is evidence that Sunday was added to the Sabbath, and there's a lot of that evidence. And here's one. Notice they're saying, and the argument, you read this in a lot of the sources, a lot of the early church fathers, they say, look, you're supposed to be working. Jesus said, I work and my Father works. They would quote that. They quote, in the sweat of your face you shall eat bread. They quote, he that does not work, let him not eat. Now, none of those scriptures say anything about working on the Sabbath one way or the other. But they quote these verses that have to do with working to make the point that you should not rest. And they called it being idle. I think it says it right here. They called it idle, wasted time. You should not rest on the Sabbath. That was their angle. That was their angle. That's how they attacked the Sabbath. So you should not rest. Why? I'm not a psychologist, but you can imagine. You know, the devil hates God's law, number one, but you know, the fact that the Jews thought they could get a day off and the rest of the empire didn't, maybe they're jealous. I don't know. But there was a lot of this. You read it. You read, not in relaxation of the body, admiring the workmanship of God. You know, that's, we should admire the workmanship of God, but not relaxing the body. Not eating things prepared the day before. You know, that's what the Jews would do, right? Because they weren't going to cook on the Sabbath. They weren't going to warm up their coffee on the Sabbath. See, what's it say here? Using lukewarm drinks. You can read, well, we're going to read something from Justin Martyr later. And in his dialogue with Trypho, he says, you know, I have a hot drink on a Sabbath. You know, ha, 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 I have a hot drink. Because the Jews wouldn't have hot drink on a Sabbath because they're not going to kindle a fire. So it's all about the, I would say, physical things of Sabbath keeping. I'm not saying they're not important. God says don't work on the Sabbath. But the attacks on the Sabbath were attacks on not working. Originally, that was the main attack. And then they added Sunday. Notice Ignatius doesn't say anything about, in this, at least in this version, doesn't say anything about getting rid of the Sabbath or not observing a Sabbath. You end up having a weekend. I didn't bring the sources, but there's one source that says that basically you give slaves both days off. Because later on, I'm not going to get to that point, way later on, the idea of not working on the Sabbath came back into fashion, but also on Sunday. So they kind of said, well, we got to have the whole weekend off. So those of us, you know, live today are appreciative of that it happened. But initially, you work 7 days a week. Only the Jews got one day off. And the rest of the empire began attacking that. The church began attacking that. So what we have here in the early part of the second century is the Sabbath being observed, maybe in a different way, and Sunday being added to it. So this begins to answer the question, where does Sunday come from? Why? You know, that's a whole other issue, and we can talk about Jesus being resurrected on Sunday and all that. I don't know. There are connections to pagan sun worship as well, although nobody seems to be making those connections this early in history. Ignatius wrote another letter to the Philippians, and from chapter 13 he says, if anyone fasts on the Lord's Day or on the Sabbath, except on the Paschal Sabbath, the Sabbath around, I think he's talking about Easter, or right around Easter, he is a murderer of Christ. So here he's saying that we know from the Bible, I'm reading into this a little bit, you and I know that from the scriptures the Sabbath is a feast day. And here Ignatius is saying also Sunday, the Lord's Day, they're calling it the Lord's Day already, that day needs to be a feast day. So again, I believe there's more evidence that Sunday was being added, but the Sabbath was not being eliminated. It was not a question of replacing one with the other. We're adding this new Christian day. On the other hand, much later, and I think we'll see this in one of the clips, Marcion, who was denounced as a heretic, he hated the Old Testament God. He only liked the grace of the New Testament God. And he also had his own idea of what books belong in the Bible and didn't, and so forth. But, and he was eventually, he was eventually excommunicated by the Roman Church. Left that word out for his other heresies. But Marcion suggested, and finally the Roman Church imposed a Sabbath fast, the opposite of what God says. You should fast on the Sabbath and feast on Sunday. Now, the interesting thing, and I'm not going to get into the Sabbath fast yet because that's much later, and I don't think we get into it in the sermon, but again, the interesting thing is if you prescribe a Sabbath fast, what does that tell you? There's still a Sabbath. They might be saying you should fast on the Sabbath, but there's still a Sabbath. All right, there's another one called from the early the early writings of quote-unquote church fathers that are, this one's called the Epistle of Barnabas. And the reason I say quote-unquote is because we don't even know who Barnabas is. It's not the apostle. Almost nobody thinks it's the apostle Barnabas. This Barnabas is supposed to, is thought anyway, to have come from Alexandria. And in chapter 16, and this is, again, supposed to be an early book, late in the first century or early in the second century. He says, behold, they who have cast down this temple, even they shall build it up again. This is why we're going to get the timing here. It has so happened, all right? Behold, they who have cast down this temple, even they shall build it up again. It has so happened. But through their going to war, it was destroyed by their enemies, and now they, as the servants of their enemies, shall rebuild it. All right? This places this writing between 70 AD when the temple was destroyed and 135, the Bar Kokhba revolt, because Hadrian destroyed Jerusalem in 135 and he built a pagan temple on the site of the second temple, and he would not allow the Jews to come back to Jerusalem, kicked them all out, wouldn't let them come back. So whoever this Barnabas was, when he says it has so happened, in other words, the temple's been destroyed by their enemies and now they're going to rebuild it, that places him between the writing between when it was destroyed and 135, because after 135 everybody knew it couldn't be rebuilt because you had a pagan shrine on there right now. So that's why we think that the Epistle to Barnabas is written in the end of the first century or beginning of the second century. This letter uses allegory. It's the explanation of Scripture as a symbol or a metaphor like Philo does. Now, here's an example, and you might agree with this example. Maybe, the Sabbath is mentioned at the beginning of creation. Thus, God made in 6 days the works of it his hands, and on the seventh day he rested and sanctified it. Attend, my children, to the meaning of this expression. He finishes in 6 days. This implies that the Lord will finish all things in 6,000 years, for a day with him is as 1,000 years. He rested on the seventh day. This means when his son, coming again, shall destroy the time of the wicked man and judge the ungodly and change the sun, the moon, and the stars, then he shall truly rest on the seventh day. Many of us believe that. But this is an allegory. The Bible doesn't flat out say, it does say a day with the Lord is as 1,000 years, but it doesn't flat out give a chronology in years of when certain things are going to happen. But we've kind of had this as part of our tradition. It's an old tradition, goes back to the first century. It was interesting to find this out. But we must be careful when we base doctrine on an allegory, on a metaphor. Paul did it. But I think, to be fair, Paul used allegory to support doctrine that he already understood. So we don't want to make a new doctrine based on an allegory, but Barnabas does. Not only does he say a day is like 1,000 years, which the Bible says, and then say that man has 6,000 years and God's going to have a seventh, but he says right after that, your new moons and your Sabbath I cannot endure. You perceive how he speaks, Barnabas is saying. Your present Sabbaths are not acceptable to me, but that is what which I have made. Namely, when giving rest to all things, I shall make a beginning of the eighth day. That is, a beginning of another world. Wherefore also we keep the eighth day with joyfulness, a day on which Jesus rose again from the dead. So Barnabas says, okay, he's taking this metaphor even further, and he's saying, after the seventh day we have a new world, new heaven, new earth. I'm all for the new heaven and new earth, but that to me doesn't say we keep the eighth day, but to Barnabas it does. The eighth day being the day after the seventh day, Sunday. Okay? So here's more evidence from early in the second century at the latest that people were beginning to have the idea that Sunday is the day for Christians. It was beginning to keep be accepted. Now, Barnabas, I think the best guess is that he's from Alexandria. And what you have also is an Alexandrian way of looking at things, and you have a Roman way of looking at things, and you have a Constantinopolitan way of looking at things. You have an Antiochian, and you have a Judean or a Jerusalem way of looking at things. Why is that? Because in the early church, you had five large centers of influence and five leading bishops. If you were a bishop in any one of those areas, you were one of the big cheeses. And it was only after a long time that the Roman bishop became Pope in a way that he was over the rest of them. For the longest time, and I don't have an exact quote here as to when that is, but for hundreds of years, he was maybe the chief among equals. And before that, he was just one of the five. Okay? So, Sunday gained acceptance in Alexandria, perhaps, and Rome, perhaps. But there's a lot of evidence that from the east, which is Constantinople, the capital of the Byzantine Empire, and Antioch and Jerusalem, that Sunday was not gaining acceptance. You don't see as much evidence from there. You see some talk about it, but not much. Not like you do in the rest of the church. Okay, I think I got one more from this video. This is DVD. Welcome back, young people. What did you have in your study? Anybody want to tell me? You forget already. So I brought these videos. I'm glad you're here to see them. About what? Somebody, I can't hear too. Hmm? Oh, about the creation. Okay, good.
In particular, the Sabbath.
Yeah, the creation. Oh. The Sabbath is a memorial of creation. Right. Okay, one more from this video.
Alexandria, Egypt, founded in 332 BC by Alexander the Great, one of the world's great centers of literature, science, and commerce, a melting pot of religious ideas and classical philosophy. There is solid evidence that Christians in Alexandria were the first to replace Sabbath observance with first day, that is, Sunday worship. This began shortly before 120 AD.
One of the first documents that we find pointing to Christian keeping of Sunday is the so-called Epistle of Barnabas. Now, it is not the real Barnabas that we read about in the New Testament in the book of Acts. This is pseudo-Barnabas. It's a pseudepigraphon. It's falsely attributed to him. But it was written apparently by somebody in Alexandria in Egypt, where the tendency was to spiritualize everything. And that's what this Epistle of Barnabas does. It doesn't take anything literally.
Barnabas believes that the Hebrew Scriptures is a gift to those who truly understand it. But he thinks the ones who understand it will not take it literally, but will understand it in a metaphorical or spiritual sense.
Barnabas claims that he and his followers are observing the eighth day of the week, the day after the Sabbath, obviously Sunday. It condemns Judaism and everything associated with it, including observance of the seventh-day Sabbath.
The Barnabas letter is the first evidence of Sunday being promoted as the Christian day of worship. But to find the real heart of the pro-Sunday movement, we have to shift our focus from Alexandria westward to the heart of the Roman Empire. It is in ancient Rome that we find the first description of early Christian Sunday keeping. It comes from Justin Martyr, a convert to the new faith.
But Sunday is the day on which we all hold our common assembly, because it is the first day on which God, having wrought a change in the darkness and matter, made the world. And Jesus Christ, our Savior, on the same day, rose from the dead.
Early Christian Sunday keepers needed a theological justification for keeping the first day of the week, and they found it in linking the first day to the first day of creation. In doing that, they were denying the authority of Christ, who declared himself to be Lord of the Sabbath, the seventh day of creation.
We have reached a critical...
Any comments about that? Justin Martyr. You mentioned Justin Martyr. I have a lot. He wrote a lot, put it that way. He called himself a Samaritan. He was from Shechem, the area around Shechem, which is modern-day Nablus, which would be, you know, we call it Palestine, or the east, well, it'd be part of the West Bank now, lived from 100 to 165. He probably had a Greek or a Roman father. He wasn't Jewish. He was reared a pagan, and he became a philosopher. Notice that in the video there, he was called a convert. One of the early, and of course, you know, everybody's got to be a convert to Christianity, but in this case, he had been a philosopher and reared in paganism. And yet he became a church leader. Interestingly enough, after he became a Christian, he still wore his philosopher's gown. And this, he said, was to indicate that he had attained the truth. Now, what we know about Justin Martyr was because of what he wrote. He wrote a lot. He left a lot to us. And so that's where we get the idea. Eusebius mentions 8 writings of his. Others make mention of even more. In one of them, it's called a dialogue with Trypho, or Trypho, I'm not sure how to say that. A Jew, Justin seeks to show that Christianity is the law for all men, not the law given by God to the Jews. He claims this law was given to the Jews. Now, dialogues, for those of you that might not be familiar with it, it's a common form of exposition by Greek philosophers where they would imagine a conversation between themselves, usually, and someone else, or perhaps between two people, where different aspects of whatever is being discussed, you know, one guy would take one view, the other guy would take this view, and they'd write the dialogue. And this persisted, I think, through the Middle Ages. I think, if I can remember right, and have bad memory, that Galileo even, didn't he write a dialogue about some of the, or Copernicus, one of those guys? They wrote dialogues. It's a way of, I think Galileo did. It's a way of saying what you want to say, for Galileo, I think it was, without actually saying it. You put it in a dialogue and you can claim, well, that wasn't me. That was these two guys talking in a book I wrote. And yet you can make a point. So Justin wrote this dialogue with Trypho from chapter 21. He says, moreover, that God enjoined you, this is Justin talking to Trypho, that God enjoined you to keep the Sabbath and impose on you other precepts for a sign. As I've already said, and it's a long book, he's said a lot of things already, on account of your unrighteousness and that of your fathers. And he declares that for the sake of the nations, lest his name be profaned among them, and therefore he permitted some of you to remain alive. These words of his I can prove to you. They are narrated by Ezekiel, and then he starts quoting Ezekiel. All right, do you get his point there? Justin is saying, God gave you, Jews, the law because you are disobedient and unrighteous. And he, by giving you the law, and if you don't keep it, it proves to the other nations, it's a way of God clearing his own name. He gave you this horrible law that includes the Sabbath, he'll mention later, includes the Sabbath. And that's a sign that you are the unrighteous people. That's the point that Justin's trying to make. And he uses Ezekiel 20. I am the Lord your God. It quotes, I don't know from what version, you know, this isn't a literal quote from anything that we have now, but it's close. I am the Lord your God, walk in my statutes, keep my judgments, and take no part in the customs of Egypt, and hallow my Sabbaths, and they shall be a sign between me and you, that you may know that I am the Lord your God. That's what God said, that's what he intended, right? Justin's saying it's a sign that we would know who the Jews were and that they're evil. But Ezekiel didn't say that. God said it's a sign that they may know who God is. Notwithstanding, you rebelled against me, and your children walked not in my statutes, neither kept my judgments to do them, which if a man do, he shall live in them. And then Ezekiel, he goes through all, in this chapter, he's going through the different rebellions of Israel in the wilderness and then later. And he continued, but they pollute my Sabbaths. And I said that I would pour out my fury upon them in the wilderness to accomplish my anger upon them. Yet I did not, that my name might not be altogether profaned in the sight of the heathen. So Justin misquotes that a little bit, doesn't he? He says that God gave them the law so that he might not be profaned. Whereas God says, I didn't destroy them in the wilderness because I didn't want my name to be profaned. I just delivered them from Egypt, so I chose not to destroy them in the wilderness because it made me look bad, to put it in the vernacular. It would reflect badly on what God was doing. Justin misquotes that, twists it. Okay, I led them out before their eyes. I lifted up my hand upon them in the wilderness that I would scatter them among the heathen and disperse them through the countries because they had not executed my judgments but had despised my statutes and polluted my Sabbaths, and their eyes were after the devices of their father. Here's where Justin gets his point. Wherefore I gave them also statutes that were not good and judgments whereby they shall not live, and I shall pollute them in their own gifts, that I may destroy all that open the womb when I pass through them. Okay? So Ezekiel is saying God was patiently working with Israel for his name's sake. You can look it up, Ezekiel 20 and verse 17 and verse 22. But eventually he gave up and he just turned them over. Just like, you do what you want. You know, I'm through with you. Okay? God gave up in the short term. I mean, he has a long-term plan for redemption. But he was... In the story of the whole Bible, there's that time when God says, okay, I'm through with you. You're through with me, I'll be through with you. You go into captivity, you'll come to repentance later. Turn them over to their own devices, verse 25 and 26. So Justin's view is that the Mosaic law was given in the first place, originally, to Israel because of their sin. That's his point. Not that God gave a good and a perfect law that they didn't keep, but God gave them a bad law. Now, we don't believe that, obviously. So, there's a whole lot. Justin's dialogue with Trifo is a very long dialogue, a lot of things in there. His point is that the law was really bad. It wasn't a good thing. And the Jews were, the Jews need to come to Christianity. Not that they don't need to come to Christianity, but it's not because the Torah is bad. That's not why. But that's Justin's point. So, by the middle of the second century, which is when Justin was writing, some parts of Christianity were well along the path to distancing themselves from Judaism and the law. Because that's, if you want to say, I don't like the Jews, okay, back then, you might not like them personally for whatever reason, but in order to distance yourself from the Jews, you need to distance yourself from their law. And what's their law? Well, it's the first 22 or 49, depending on how you count them, books of this. Christianity had to distance itself from God's law in order to distance itself from Judaism. Okay, I'm going to move into the 4th century. I'm skipping a lot of information that I will cover later in a different sermon. I just want to deal with the Sabbath today. In 364, we're not sure about that date, but it's close, there was a local council. Some councils in the, like the Council of Nicaea was a huge thing where, Constantine made sure that all the bishops from all over the world came, the five different important regions, they all came, right? But there were also smaller conclaves, if you want to call it that, or meetings or councils of bishops that took place in particular regions. The Council of Laodicea being up in Asia Minor, was a local council, not a huge one. Here's Canon 29. Christians must not Judaize by resting on the Sabbath, but must work on that day, rather honoring the Lord's day. And if they can, resting then as Christians. But if any shall be found to be Judaizers, let them be anathema from Christ. You know, they couldn't take communion and all. And later on, it could be killed. So here again, the attack is on resting on the Sabbath. But now you see, it's beginning to change its flavor. We're a couple of centuries later, right? Remember before, need to work on Saturday. It still says that, but now it says rest on Sunday if you can. Don't have to, but if you can. We're beginning to see a little bit of trying to take some of the commands of the Sabbath and apply them to Sunday. At first, they weren't trying to do that at all. Now, by the time you get to the 4th century, we're doing it a little bit. Canon 49. During Lent, the bread must not be offered except on Sabbath day and the Lord's day only. What does this tell you? We're in the 4th century, 364. We've got Canon 29 and Canon 49 dealing with the Sabbath. What does that tell you? Some people were still keeping it. Apparently a lot of people, at least in the area of Laodicea, in Asia Minor. They had to have rules about what to do on the Sabbath. It was still a factor. When you read some of the books, and this is why I didn't read this whole book. I skimmed it. I've read some others. When you read some of the sources, not original sources, when you read some of the discussions of the sources, modern writers, the 19th, 20th centuries, and now 21st century, kind of want to paint this picture that after Jesus was resurrected and he taught his disciples for a little while there before he ascended to heaven, that the churches began to transition to Sunday right away. And that this idea of Sunday spread out from Jerusalem all over the empire. It's in this book, says it. That's bunk. That's just not true. I don't think this original sources support that at all. And here you are in Asia Minor, which is pretty far from Jerusalem, but still in the east, the eastern part of the empire, where they find a need in the middle of the 4th century to have rules about what you can do on the Sabbath. People are still keeping the Sabbath. The Council of Constantinople was another local council. There had been a large council in 382, and then a local council in 382. Constantinople, where's that, in the Bosporus? Is that what that's called? The between the Black Sea? I get the seas mixed up. It's up there to the east side of Turkey, if I got it right. You can look in your map. But it was the capital of the eastern portion of the Roman Empire, or the Byzantine Empire, as it came to be known. It was the capital, or became the headquarters, if you want to call it that, of the Eastern Church, the Orthodox Church. Canon 16 from this particular one. Gospels are to be read on the Sabbath, that is Saturday, with other scriptures. So they had a discussion about what were the proper things to be read on the Sabbath. Because they, as Mike's saying, there are services on all different days. But in particular on the Sabbath, and increasingly so on Sunday. So now in Canon 16, in 382, at the Council of Constantinople says, Gospels are okay to be read. Apparently before that they weren't reading the Gospels. I'm not going to go any further. We could go further in history with more references, and maybe I will someday. But it's clear that at least until the end of the 4th century, we're at 382, at least until the end of the 4th century, that in the Roman Empire, not to mention other parts of the world like perhaps India and China and so forth, there were people keeping the Sabbath in some form. Enough people keeping the Sabbath that councils of the Catholic Church, so the Universal Roman Church, found it necessary to make rules about what you should and should not do on the Sabbath day. If it was a non-issue, if it had been done and gone away back in the first or second century, why, 200 years later, they're still making rules up about it? And you'll find, if you want to do the research, if I ever get time to do it later, present to you, that it goes all the way through the Middle Ages and to our time. They're Sabbath keepers, but obviously less and less as time went on. Okay, one more video from this. From this particular DVD. I think one of the points I want to make here is that, you know, we are painted sometimes, I think, as some weird minority because we keep a Saturday Sabbath. When, you know, and, oh, that's, you know, the church never did that. Well, you know what? The church did do it, and it did it for a lot of years. But the Western church got away from it. The Eastern church kept doing it, at least large portions of it, for a long time. And when they did start compromising, if you want to put it that way, or observing Sunday, they basically were keeping 2 days, even hundreds and hundreds of years, for hundreds and hundreds of years. So I just wanted to give you that perspective. Things have changed, but it was a change that took a long time and went very slowly. It didn't happen like right away because the apostles decided they were going to do this, or Paul decided we're going to do this. It's taken thousands of years, the whole process. All right, here's another clip from this video.
The Constantine Sunday law settled the Saturday-Sunday issue, not according to the records from the ancient city of Laodicea, where church leaders met near the middle of the 4th century.
The church council of Laodicea dealt specifically with the issue of what scriptures, if any, should be read at Sabbath services.
The Gospels are to be read on the Sabbath, that is, Saturday, with the other scriptures.
The fact that the council addressed this issue is irrefutable proof that Christian church members were still attending worship services on the seventh-day Sabbath. Remember, this is more than 300 years after Christ. But there's more.
Christians must not Judaize by resting on the Sabbath, but must work on that day, rather honoring the Lord's day. And if they can, resting then as Christians. But if any shall be found to be Judaizers, let them be anathema from Christ.
What did the council mean by Judaizers? Judaizers were those Christians who did not work on Sabbath, like the Jews. Church leaders wanted everyone to work on Sabbath and to refrain from work on the first day of the week, which they now called the Lord's Day. And this was consistent with the Sunday law enacted by the Emperor Constantine.
In spite of the popularity of sun worship and the Sunday laws of emperors, many Christians continued to worship on the seventh-day Sabbath. In fact, Christian churches that abandoned the Sabbath were in the minority.
For although almost all churches throughout the world celebrate the sacred mysteries on the Sabbath of every week, yet the Christians of Alexandria and of Rome, on account of some ancient tradition, have ceased to do this.
Without question, Christians were still observing the seventh-day Sabbath clear down in the second half of the 4th century. In spite of theological arguments, anti-Jewish prejudice, and the decree of an emperor, the Sabbath of the Creator was not dead. The succeeding centuries saw the Sabbath at the heart of controversy between popes and patriarchs. The weekly day of rest and worship became a test of church authority and a sign of submission to the sovereignty of a new kind of religious government. It became a major cause of the great rift that divided the Christian church for 900 years. More about that when we return with part 3 of the seventh day.
I apologize for some of the repetition. I had done a lot of research and a lot of work, and then I got these DVDs out, and found, of course, you know, there's only so much information out there, so obviously they're going to cover the same things. But it's important to know that the Sabbath did survive. And I know this. Much of this is review for some of you that are old-timers, but we've got young people among us that maybe haven't heard some of this before or seen it demonstrated to them from the original sources. And I hope that there's something in this presentation that even if you've been around forever and studied it before, I hope you learned something. In spite of the Roman Church's best efforts to eradicate it, Sabbath worship survived, and it flourished into the Middle Ages and beyond. I mentioned before that I will save Constantine, you know, that individual, the lawyer there mentioned Constantine's law you know, Constantine had an edict, a Sunday edict, 321 A.D., that everyone should worship on the venerable day of the sun and so forth. I want to talk about Constantine later, because what happened between in the first part of the 4th century is very, very important in church history, and it deserves an entire presentation all to itself. So we'll do that sometime. What Constantine did and what it set the stage for what happened all after for 1,000 years after that, and still today. And if we understand that and understand what happened when the Roman Empire embraced Christianity, we'll understand a lot more about our own time now and about the history between then and now. The Sabbath is to be a joy, and it is a joy to us. It's not a fast day. It's not a day that we should not look forward to, but the church actually tried to make it be something like that. So we're going to end. The sermon will end, and I'll pick this up at another time in another sermon. I'll just throw this out. I thought about if it would seem something that is good, I'm speaking again in a couple of weeks, taking a blank spot on the schedule. I could speak about the Sabbath in more detail, if that would seem to be helpful. If not, I will proceed on into some more things about history. But it may be good. I'd like to get some feedback from you, not the second, but after the service. It may be good to review some of our foundational beliefs about the Sabbath and why. And, you know, I've done it from a historical perspective now, but there's a theological perspective too. And perhaps that might be good to do in 2 weeks. So get back to me on that. We'll end the sermon on this video as soon as I can bring it up. Oh, a song on the Sabbath.
The history of the early Christian centuries reveals the definite anti-Seventh-day Sabbath, pro-Sunday movement. And church documents unmistakably identify the religious establishment at Rome as its nerve center. The Roman drive to replace the Seventh-day Sabbath with Sunday got a big boost back in 321 A.D. That's the year Constantine ordered state-authorized Sunday observance. Oddly enough, in spite of his professed Christianity, there was very little Christian about his first Sunday law. In fact, it sounds a lot like a call to pagan sun worship.
On the venerable day of the sun, let the magistrates and people residing in cities rest, and let all workshops be closed.
With a sympathetic emperor on the throne, the leaders of the Roman Church gained power and influence. In their councils, they took bold steps to enforce Sunday observance and to urge desecration of the biblical Sabbath. Some of their actions took on a definite anti-Jewish flavor.
Christians must not Judaize by resting on the Sabbath, but must work on that day, rather honoring the Lord's Day, Sunday, and if they can, resting then as Christians. But if any shall be found to be Judaizers, let them be anathema from Christ.
These pronouncements against Judaizers referred to those who, like the Jews, refused to work on the Sabbath. Christians who did this were to be excommunicated, kicked out of the church. This extreme position against the Sabbath, combined with a strong pro-Sunday stance, became a pillar of Roman Catholic teaching. The Sabbath, the Sunday change, became a mark of Roman Catholic or papal authority. In 602, Pope Gregory identified Sabbath keepers with the Antichrist. He called them Judaizers because of their determination to observe the seventh day as a day for rest and worship.
It has come to my ears that certain men of perverse spirit have sown among you some things that are wrong and opposed to the holy faith, so as to forbid any work done on the Sabbath day.
Christians in the Italian city of Milan dared to openly observe the Sabbath no matter what the leadership in Rome wanted.
The Church of Milan followed the churches of the East. It seems the Saturday was held in a fair esteem, They, the churches of the East, came together on the Sabbath day to worship Jesus Christ, the Lord of the Sabbath.
Over the centuries, the attempt to establish Sunday as a substitute for the biblical Sabbath was probably only mildly successful. But the campaign was really intensified with a move that threatened to drive a deep wedge between the Eastern and Western branches of Christianity. This move involved a direct assault on the very nature and purpose of Sabbath observance.
What was this direct assault? It was a rule forbidding Christians to eat on the seventh day. In other words, a Sabbath fast. This was an anti-Jewish idea that probably originated with Marcion, a heretic who was kicked out of the church back in the second century.
Marcion wanted to discredit the Sabbath because it was an image of creation. For him, creation was an evil deed of an evil God, the God of the Old Testament. He distinguished the God of the Old Testament from the God of the New, the God of love. But the church rejected this because creation was a good deed, and the God of the Old Testament is the same with the God of the New. So he turned a celebratory day into a day of lament, and that was his intention. This is why he introduced the Sabbath fast.
In spite of its action against him, the church salvaged his fast idea and used it to make the seventh day Sabbath unappealing.
Now, this was absolutely contrary to what had been taught in Judaism. In Judaism, Sabbath was a day of feasting. In fact, to fast on the Sabbath meant to break the Sabbath. And so this was another way of distancing Christianity from Judaism.
Turning the Sabbath day into a day without food was a very effective strategy, especially since the sixth day, Friday, was also a day of fasting for many believers. In a single generation, young Christians grew up with a built-in dislike for the Sabbath, the day of fasting and gloom, and with a corresponding attraction to Sunday, the day of celebration and feasting.
It was the church in Rome that championed the fasting on Sabbath and the feasting on Sunday. In fact, in the 4th century, Pope Sylvester said that it was good to do this in contempt of the Jews.
If every Sunday is to be observed joyfully by the Christians on account of the resurrection, then every Sabbath on account of the burial is to be regarded in execration of the Jews.
In other words, Christians were told to fast on the Sabbath as an expression of their contempt for the Jews, even as an acted-out curse against them. But even this particular anti-Sabbath strategy was only partly successful. Prominent church leaders opposed it. Hippolytus, a 3rd-century bishop, felt it was a big mistake.
Even today, some order fasting on the Sabbath, of which Christ has not spoken, dishonoring even the gospel of Christ.
There is even a report that Augustine, one of the most influential of the Roman Church Fathers, came to the defense of church members who ignored the Sabbath fast.
The leaders of Rome were eventually successful in imposing the Sabbath fast on their followers in the Western world of Christianity. But the same could not be said for what happened in the East. Where the Orthodox influence was strongest, Eastern Christianity resisted this, and their views on the Sabbath were really quite different.
Sabbath fasting does not make any sense for the Orthodox, because the Sabbath is the day that marks two great events, the completion of creation and the completion of redemption. So Sabbath is a day of double celebration and could never be associated with fasting and lament.